From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Johnny Cougar hit it big in the early 80s with arena rock anthems and little ditties about Jack and Diane, about love and work amid America's unpredictable amber waves. John Cougar Mellencamp reclaimed his given name and rejected the pigeonhole of terminal Hoosier. For the last decade and more, John Mellencamp has told stories of American life in lunch bucket rockers whittled clean of rock and roll escapism, rolling way beyond the heartland with values of faith, hard work, and always a skeptical eyebrow cocked toward authority. Mellencamp has made 21 albums, sold 40 million records, and put 29 singles in the top 40. His gift for hooks and melodies is legendary. So is what the Village Voice has celebrated as his bratty inner hick, a New York compliment to a musician who has made his own questioning way. Mellencamp helped organize Farm Aid with Willie Nelson. He had a heart attack on tour in 1994 and came back to sing about peace and racism. Now he's out with a tribute album of steel-tipped folk and blues songs, picking up on the tradition of Woody Guthrie, Hoagie Carmichael, and bluesman Robert Johnson. The man dubbed Mr. Middle America by ABC News has traveled back to the roots of American music, back to the day when songs took on heaven and hell, God and the devil, war and peace. John Mellencamp does the American thing yet again and makes the music his own. Tonight on Point, Riding the Rails with John Mellencamp. Joining me now from Bloomington, Indiana, is John Mellencamp, musician and songwriter. His new CD is titled Trouble No More. Welcome, John Mellencamp.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and what a great sound in your new album. How did you decide to turn back the hands of time to get back into this folk and blues and make it your own, John?
Well, I had not really had a record deal. I left my record company after Cutting Heads and in kind of a mind state that maybe I didn't want to make records anymore.
Cutting Heads just a couple of years ago, and you were there with India Ree and a different sound for you, and you thought maybe no more records?
Well, quietly thinking, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. I'm so far away from what is popular today, and maybe I'll just go out and play shows. And Billy Joel did the same thing, 10 years ago? He hasn't made a record in 15, 10, 12 years. It just kind of dawned on me that it takes so much work, so much energy to put a record out, and then not to be able to facilitate your idea of what a record is supposed to do through a major record company. So I was just kind of in limbo. I was just thinking quietly to myself, if it was me, then I could take it personally. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just me. It was everybody of my age group.
Mm-hmm. What, you're 50, 51, 52 now?
Yeah. All of us people are all fighting, this crazy battle. Well, it boils down to this. In the 60s and the 70s, music was about dissent. Music was about rebellion. Music was about a lifestyle. It was about, it had a purpose. I grew up playing four sets a night in bars, as a teenager with my feet sticking to the beer on the on the stage. And today's popular artists were weaned at the Mickey Mouse Club, and so I just kind of thought, there's just such a difference from my upbringing in music and then playing at Disney World. That wasn't even the problem. The problem was is that I didn't notice that the American public even seemed to mind.
So at some point, that tipped you back to the land of Woody Guthrie and all the rest.
Well, to me, it was kind of like, there's just so much great music and so many great songs. So Columbia came to me. I was a friend of mine had died, the editor of Billboard magazine, a guy named Timothy White.
Yeah.
And some of us did shows at the Fleet Center and at Madison Square Garden for Timothy. And
long-time editor of Billboard, a big mentor and friend of yours, John Mellencamp.
Yeah, he was a real good friend of mine, and I spoke to that guy every day for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I was doing Stones in My Passway. And the record company that I had just left happened to be there, and they heard me do it, and they said, they came to me like the next day or a couple of days later and said, John, would you consider making an entire record of this stuff. And I said, well, I don't know, you know, I mean, I'm getting by with this one. We can do this song pretty good.
Right. But this is what we heard at the top, but Robert Johnson's song.
Right, but I don't know that I can do 12 of these songs pretty good. So we kind of proceeded on a let's see basis, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's just see how it goes. And so I went into a rehearsal situation with the guys in the band, and, well, actually before that I did months of research, but then I went into a rehearsal situation with the band, and
John Mellencamp,
the record was made.
We want to hear all about that, but we want to hear the music off your new album, Trouble No More, as well. We've got Johnny Hart, the old Woody Guthrie song, queued up here. Tell us a little bit about this song, why you chose it for the album.
Well, I don't think Johnny Hart was written by Woody Guthrie, although he made it famous. You know, in my research, I found out so much. I mean, you know, I'm not a research-oriented type of guy.
We can believe that.
You know, Tim White was, and his wife told me the other day, she said that was one of Tim's best things, was that he researched everything so much. And when people die, she said, sometimes they pass on their best trait to their friends. Maybe I got his research, but we researched this record for 3 or 4 months. I had Legacy involved, which is a record company that put out the Robert Johnson record. And then I had the Smithsonian, and I had a lot of people looking for material for me.
And let's listen for a minute to John Mellencamp's version of the song that Woody Guthrie made famous, Johnny Hart.
Johnny Hart, he was a desperate little man. Had a razor, ran a pistol every day. Cut down a man on the free state line. You should have seen Johnny Hart getting away, oh Lord. See Johnny Hart getting away. Johnny Hart made a run for the free state line. Yeah, he thought he'd be free. A man came walking and grabbed him by the arm, saying, Johnny, come along with me, poor boy. Johnny, come along with me. Johnny Hart, he wrote his mom and dad, saying, come here and go, my bear. But money won't go, his murdering charge. They laid Johnny Hart back in jail.
Johnny Hart, Living the Rough Life there, sung by John Mellencamp on his new album, Trouble No More. John, I want to talk about all the politics that you ran into with this album, because, of course, this music has a strong political lineage. But first, just on the music side, what was the gear shift for you, John Mellencamp, to get into this world, this mindset, this music?
What I discovered real early is that you have to perform these songs. You just can't go in the recording studio. I've had my own recording studio since 83. Mm-hmm. But you just can't go in the studio and say, okay, we're going to record Johnny Hart. You can, but it'll just sound, you know, kind of not real and not part of you. So what we did, we went in and re-rehearsed Johnny Hart and the rest of the songs on this record, once we decided what they were, for hundreds of times. Every time a musician plays the material, he comes to the fabric of what makes that song work and what's making his part work.
You've had so many big hit records. You've played the huge crowds. You've sold millions of records. So you clearly had a very big contemporary career. What's the arc of that journey to get back to the fabric, as you call it, of these songs?
Well, performing the songs. The last 10 albums I've made, you know, every song was written and performed in the studio. Mm-hmm. And the band never really performed the song at all, except in the process of making the record. Mm-hmm. With this record, we went back in the rehearsal room and drilled and practiced these songs so that each musician felt as if the part was theirs. They had invented the part. And as it was, they did, because so much of what you're hearing was changed by the musicians, by me, from the original versions.
And how much of that journey is technique, and how much is a different spirit that you need to get close to present these songs?
Well, I couldn't have made this record 10 years ago. I was too immature. My voice was too immature. My thinking was too immature. It would have just been a cover record totally at that point. Me doing like a pale reflection of these other songs. But our goal was to make songs that sounded as if they came from us. So when you do that, you know, you have to perform these songs. I don't think I couldn't have been 29 years old and made this record.
Because you wouldn't have related to the pain and woe and wisdom, or is it just a matter of the voice maturing?
All the above. Both, you know. I mean, you can't relate. You know, I was pretty smart at 29, I thought. And I thought I was a pretty smart guy. But, you know, the older I get, the more I realize that, you know, every day is just, you know, another journey into, like, you know, this art project that I've been living for the last 51 years.
Mm. There was some technical side to get that almost, I don't know, garage band or shotgun shack sound to this as well. You use some older technology here.
Yeah, that we, Mike Wanchek, my guitar player, has a recording studio also, and he had a 16-track machine that hadn't been dusted off probably in 20 years, and I said, let's get this 16-track machine out and fire it up and get it going. And there was no microphones or anything made after, like, 1970. Right. You know, everything was pre that. So it was amazing, too, because the first thing that you check when you go in the studio is your kick drum, because that's the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. That's your foundation.
Right.
So we put up that 16-track machine, then we put an old ribbon mic in front of it, and the drummer went boom. And we just looked at each other and thought, man, what have we done?
Yeah, it really does kick.
Well, we have sacrificed such beauty for technology, and it was just like, so we just kind of sat there for like a half an hour, made him kick it and just listen to it, because he kept going, is something wrong? No, nothing's wrong. We're just fiddling around with the sound. But you can actually hear the room on that kick drum, which is like an amazing thing. You know, if you listen to kick drums today, they're just synthesized sounds that off of a Pro Tools generally, and so there's no feeling or no room or no emotion. But I mean, you know, to hear a kick drum actually give you something other than the thud was like, wow, that's great.
We're going to come back and talk about the whole big world and John Mellencamp's view of it and a little bit of a buzzsaw he ran into with his new album, Trouble No More. I want to go into a break with a song that Hoagy Carmichael wrote in your hometown, essentially, John Mellencamp, in Bloomington, Indiana, Baltimore Oriole. Tell us about the song.
Well, when I first heard it, you know, I mean, I have been familiar with Hoagy Carmichael my whole life because, you know, he's from Bloomington. I live in Bloomington. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I only really knew his most famous works. But the guy from Sony Legacy sent me this song with a bunch of other ones, and he said, listen to this. And when I first heard it, I didn't get it because Hoagy's version was so jazzy and West Coast jazz sounding. I thought, well, I don't know if that really goes on the record. But then I listened to it a couple times, and I just fell in love with the song. And then we rearranged it. And the lyrical content is just so accurate and unusual and poignant. I just love the song.
Let's listen to it. Baltimore Oriole, Hoagy Carmichael song, sung here by John Mellencamp from his new CD, Trouble No More.
Baltimore Oriole took a look at the Mercury 40 below. No life for a lady to be dragging her feathers around in the snow. Off she flew to the tangible, where a two-timing Jaybird met the divine missile. I like to revel his plumage, Baltimore Oriole. Mess around with the big guy till he sends the wings. Forgiving is easy, it's a woman life. Now and then it happened to me, slain. Send her back home and on, without her wondering how she could sing. Make a lonely man happy, Baltimore.
We're talking tonight with John Mellencamp. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with John Mellencamp about his new CD, Trouble No More. He takes a musical journey back to folk and blues. Here's a track from that CD, originally performed by Dickie Doo, a.k.a. Dave Allard and Marion Smith, entitled Teardrops Will Fall. Teardrops Will Fall from John Mellencamp's new album, Trouble No More. John Mellencamp, you take a lot of trips on this album in the Mississippi, into the Mississippi Delta and all over. This one, both with that sort of vintage Mellencamp top and even the lyrics seem the closest to what we think of as John Mellencamp. How did you choose this song for the album?
Well, I grew up listening to this song. I mean, it was my dad's only 20 years older than me. Mm-hmm. So he was a young guy, a kid having kids, basically. And, you know, he had music around the house, and I just remember this song, you know. So when we started messing with it, started, you know, playing it and rehearsing it, it just started taking on the traditional, what, you know, everybody thinks would I should sound like. So in a way, when we were doing it, I thought it was kind of good because it kind of just showed the listener that there wasn't that much of a leap from what I've been doing to what my heritage in the music really is.
Mm. The linkage is strong. It comes right down. You can hear it in this kind of barroom rocker here. You've been quoted saying that blues has been picked up and essentially, you said, methodically ruined by white guys over the years, that you yourself, when you were a young man, didn't even realize the debt, and more than the debt, the kind of direct taking of so many songs of the early rockers that came right out of black blues.
Right.
Did you have any idea? And what's the ruination you're talking about there?
Well, you know, the early English artists like the Rolling Stones and the Yardbirds, those people and Cream, those English guys were really into American blues, and a lot of the material that they did, you know, like the Stones' first four albums, I think they only wrote two or three songs on the whole. Now, they might have said they wrote more than that.
Right. But listen closely.
But listen closely. It was American Blues. But they did such a wonderful job on it that, you know, we all thought that they had written those songs because here it was our music in our, you know, in our house, and it took these guys to bring it to us. But what they did do, and I think the reason they were able to do that was because they were performing these songs. They were out playing these songs wherever they were playing at the time as a young band, you know, in England. And these were the songs they performed. What happened, I think, over time, and I'm talking about the ruination of it, is that people just, you know, got lazy with it and just boiled it down to 16-bar boogie. Dun da dun da dun da dun da dun da dun da dun. Okay, we've heard that.
Yes, we have.
Know, we've heard that, and I don't want to ever hear it again. And, you know, I could have done every song on this record probably in that fashion. And it's kind of the lazy, easy way out, you know, to play the blues. But if you listen to Robert Johnson, you listen to Son House, those notes are being performed in those songs. Mm-hmm. But there's other things going on around it, too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can go into any town in America tonight and you're going to find guys doing this material. And it's just not very good. And so, you know, for a while, you know, I would tell people, I don't even want to hear a blues song. Don't even play me anything because, you know, it's just too derivative of itself.
Give me the original or let it go. We're going to hear Death
That's
Letter
right.
from Son House a little later in the hour. But John Mellencamp, I want to turn to this album for just a minute. There's a song on here called To Washington. It's the only song that's got your moniker behind it as the author of the verse anyway, but the song has a real history. Take us back to the roots of this song.
I think the song was originally written in like 1903, something like that, and been recorded by a lot of different artists, the North Carolina Ramblers and the Carter family and Woody Guthrie. And the tradition of the song is that everybody rewrote the song and made it part of the time that they were living. And the other thing that I thought was funny and ironic was they all said they wrote it. So
right.
I thought, well, if I'm going to record the song, I have got to put my spin on it, and I've got to bring it up to date and make it political about our times. So really all I did was just look in the newspaper and watch the news, and everything in that song was pretty much being reported as I wrote it.
John, if you'll permit us, let's get the little then and now feeling here. Here's the Carter family with what they called the Cannonball, but it's the same, To Washington. This is way back, the Carter family with the tune. Then we'll hear John Mellencamp.
You can wash my jumper, starch my overhaul, catch a train they call the Cannonball from Buffalo to Washington. Comes a train coming down the track to carry me away, but ain't gonna carry me back, my honey babe, my blue-eyed babe.
When you sat down to write this song, John Mellencamp, to update the lyrics for your time, our time, we had a recent and disputed election behind us, a new president in the White House, and a war going on.
Well, that's not true. The war wasn't going on. Matter of fact, when I wrote this song, there wasn't even much talk of us going to war. There was no talk of us leaving the UN. Because if there would have been, it would have been in the song.
But you got Baghdad in here somehow.
Well, there was talk of, you know, going in. You know, it was spread. It was the very beginning. Very beginning of the whole conversation of what eventually happened, you know, knowing what I knew and what I had read about Halliburton and all that kind of stuff, I just wrote what was in the news. And then when the people heard the song, you know, there was such a wonderful job of McCarthyism going on when the war started, and a lot of people called John Mellencamp, among others, an American, which I thought was laughable.
That's a pretty good stretch.
I've been here 25 years now. I also read on that list that Jimmy Carter was an American, and I thought, wow.
Okay.
That's pretty good company.
Thought he was president.
And I thought after 25 years of making records, if you can still piss off the right, it's probably okay.
Let's listen to Washington, John Mellencamp's version, and come back and talk about it. Here it is, To Washington from his new album, Trouble No More.
So America voted on a president. No one can count on how the election went from Florida to Washington. Goddamn, said one side and the other said the same. Both look pretty guilty, but no one took the blame from coast to coast to Washington.
So there it is, To Washington, in an updated version, almost a century after it was first written, around 1901, 2003. John Mellencamp, you've got some, you're right here in the tradition of Woody Guthrie with some challenging lyrics. You read the headlines, and it sounds challenging to what's going on. You know, he wants to fight with many, and he says it's not for oil you've got in here, and if I've got it right, let's see, what is the reason to take a human life? What is the thought process to think that this is right? Can you describe what happened when this hit the sort of wartime airwaves?
I thought it was just unusual that people would think that, you know, me just really commenting on the landscape of America, mm-hmm. there's really not, you know, my opinions really aren't even hardly even it. They're in there a little bit, of course, because I wrote the song. But I tried to be pretty objective about what I was saying. I mean, was there any doubt that the economy's worse? No, there's no doubt. I just felt that, and then just, I mean, I was driving to the airport with my family going to Los Angeles, and some radio station was playing the song, and then I didn't know this, but they had a call in afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I got my two little boys with me, and some guy gets on the phone. He goes, I don't know who I hate the most, John Mellencamp or Saddam Hussein. I thought, well, what?
Wow.
I thought, well, that's kind of harsh, isn't it? You know, and I felt like if I could have had a phone, I would have felt like saying, hey, listen, I believe in peace and not killing people. But, hey, buddy, I'm not a pacifist. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I got kind of hot about it.
I wonder what your record company said. You were on the same label as the Dixie Chicks, and you know the kind of heat that they took. How did the label deal with it?
They politely, and I say this in all sincerity, they politely asked me to take the song off the record. They just thought that, you know, there was no point of this, you know, and they were in the thick of it with the Dixie Chicks. And you have to remember that, you know, for that couple month period, it was surreal around here.
It was surreal
in America. And, you know, these poor women were taking a tremendous bashing for an offhanded comment. And the record company just heard this song and thought, why do you want to do this? You know, because you're asking for it. But I just kind of said to him, hey, you know, I'm John Mellencamp. I've been writing stuff like this for years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether it went ignored or whether people paid attention to it, you know, and if they pay attention to it, great. If I take the heat, I'll take the heat. But I just didn't. I thought it was my duty. I think it's a songwriter's duty, if he chooses to do so, you know, to write about the landscape in which we're living in, mm-hmm. good, bad, or indifferent.
How did it, you know, Clear Channel Communications advised stations to stop playing the Dixie Chicks for a while there. Your song first came out on the web before the album came out, which is, I guess, why the label could ask you politely, as you say, to take the song off. You didn't. Did it get resistance? Did it get play?
No. I mean, I didn't really, when I wrote the song, I didn't really anticipate any airplay. It wasn't a song written to get airplay. You know, there's such a circle of fire you have to jump through to get on the radio anyway. Mm-hmm. And then to have a song like this and say, hey, this is my single, that, you know, any record company look right. at and go, what, are you out of your mind? Right. You know, this doesn't have, there's not one belly button ring inside on this song, Sean.
Oh, that's great. But doing it, did it put you in touch? Did it make you feel in touch with the kind of Woody Guthrie tradition? And what do you think of how American artists, American musicians are carrying or not carrying that torch these days?
Well, you know, artists young and old are not encouraged to write these type of songs. That's what makes Trouble No More an interesting record, I think, because they're songs about love, death, hatred, prison, you know, all kind of different extreme things. In today's world of corporate America and corporate record companies, they don't want no trouble. You know, they don't want to hear songs of this extreme. So you're not encouraged to write songs like To Washington because, like, you know, the record company I was with, they just wanted to turn a blind eye to it, which is different than it was in the 60s and the 70s, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. that was about dissent. That was about rebellion. The record companies, you know, were looking for that.
They were built on that, many of them.
That's exactly right. Those record companies were built on that foundation.
Have you left Columbia Records since all this, John?
This was a one-off, let's see, basis with Columbia Records. So, you know, I'm not really on Columbia Records. Mm-hmm. I just made this record. I have some friends at Columbia Records, some guys who run the joint, and I'm friendly with these people. It's not an adversarial thing. This
right.
is more of a personal thing for me, you know, what I want to do. I mean, so I'm kind of on a let's-see basis with everything right now.
Hey, you deserve to be. We're talking tonight with John Mellencamp. His new album is Trouble No More, a kind of tribute to folk and blues roots music, John Mellencamp style. Let's go into the break listening to a track from that album, Joliet Bound, originally written by Kansas Joe McCoy and Memphis Minnie McCoy. Trouble No More is the CD. Joliet Bound is the song. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with John Mellencamp. Here's a track from his new album, Trouble No More, entitled Diamond Joe.
Diamond Joe, come get me. Diamond Joe, come get me. Diamond Joe, way find me. Diamond Joe. Thank you.
original song, Diamond Joe, here updated by John Mellencamp. John Mellencamp, why this song? Once again, we ask. And what did you bring to it? In this instance, it's more than just your voice. You brought new words.
Well, Diamond Joe, the version that I originally heard was off one of the Smithsonian records. And it was just a guy, I think in prison, singing it by himself with another guy keeping time with his hands. And he had such a beautiful voice, and the melody was just so beautiful, and I just responded to it. But there just wasn't enough lyrics to make a song out of, yeah. So I had to kind of add and subtract. And then I did some research, and there's been a couple, three Diamond Joe songs written. But this song, was the original version I heard was off one of those Smithsonian records.
John, I want to ask you, you have been such a popular artist, huge songs that everybody sings, you know, the Ain't That America refrain, people just, you hear it coming out of car windows on summer nights and Pink Houses and Jack and Diane and all that from those really high volume days. You were saying earlier in the hour that not only has music changed, but you feel as though American listeners have changed. What does that feel like for the country to kind of change in a way that takes them out of your immediate range, if I understand you right?
Well, I don't know how people can really live without song. And there's just music everywhere now. I mean, it is everywhere. When I was a kid, you had to go look for it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It was, you had to go to your stereo or a particular radio station. Now it's in TV commercials. It's on, you know, it's on video games. Mm-hmm. It's in movies. Music is just everywhere. They have just exploited it and turned it into something that, you know, I don't think it originally was meant to be. But, you know, hooray for the music. But I just think that that's what happened. You know, I have a 17-year-old daughter, and she's loyal to no artist, you know, and I'm not saying that's good or bad. That's just mm-hmm. the way it is. If she likes a song, she likes a song, you know, but she doesn't, you know, it's not like she's sitting around waiting for this new person to make a record in case mm-hmm. they got another new song.
The way it used to be. And you think that's this right. is partly because music is just carpeted everywhere? People are numbed to it somehow?
I think we're just inundated with music. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if I wanted to hear music that I wanted to hear as a young adult and as a teenager, you know, I had to go specific places to get it.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't on every TV show that comes on television. I mean, there's not a television show on that, you know, even soap operas and stuff, you know, have least and my songs to play in the background. Mm-hmm. So there's always music. But when I was a kid, it wasn't that way. And if there was music, it was music I didn't want to hear.
So you had to keep looking.
Yeah, I didn't want to hear, you know, what was that guy that was always on Saturday night? He's still on. I kind of like him now. The Lawrence Welk Show.
Lawrence Welk. Is he still on? Good Lord.
Yeah,
can that be possible?
And I actually like him better now than I did when he was originally there because, you know, he's playing these great American songs. As a kid, I was thrown off by the haircuts, you know.
They were pretty severe. You personally, as far as I understand, have not allowed your songs to be sold for commercial backdrop and all the rest. Is that right?
Yeah, I haven't done that. Some people in my family think I'm a lunatic. But
well, I could see a lot of Chevy trucks over Ain't That America.
Yeah. Well, I didn't write those songs for that reason. And there's a funny story. I used to fight with Tim White about it all the time because, man, I mean, sometimes people would throw big dollars at me.
I'm sure.
And the devil would be like knocking at my door, and I'd call up Tim for moral guidance. One time I said, Tim, I don't care. I'm going to have to do this. This is just too much money.
Yeah.
And he said, "You idiot! If you do this, I'll never talk to you again." And he hung up on me. And so I went to my wife Elaine and I said, "Well, I guess we're not going to sell that song to such and such big shot company because Tim said he'd never speak to me again, and no amount of money is worth that guy's friendship."
Hey, that's what friends are for. Let's listen to a little bit of Death Letter. And before we hear your version of this one, the original is by Son House. For those listeners who don't know Son House, can you tell us a little bit about him, John Mellencamp?
What I'll tell you about Son House is that without Son House, there's no Robert Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the stuff that you hear Son House do on record today was not the original stuff he did. They went back and re-recorded him. I think it was in the, might even been the early 60s or mid 60s or something, when there was like a blues phenomenon happening. So this is really, you know, not the young Son House, where the Robert Johnson you heard was a very young man.
Right.
But if you hear Son House, you can go, whoa, well, I know where this comes from.
Yeah.
You know, I found that out a lot. Hank Williams, I Got the Lonesome Blues, oh Lord. That wasn't written by Hank Williams. It was written by a guy named Emmett Miller, who was a minstrel. Mm-hmm. And, of course, people did not pay attention to minstrels. You know, they weren't taken seriously because they were blackface. But Emmett Miller had written that song, and I was going through a bunch of old stuff, you know, researching this record. And all of a sudden I heard this guy sing. I thought, well, that's not Hank Williams. I wonder who's doing that song. And it was the original writer of the song. And it just blew me away that Hank Williams recorded that song exactly the same way that Emmett had 40 years before.
It is astonishing. Let's get Son House's version for just a second and clear here.
I got a lemon this morning, I do. You rang it red. You said, honey, girl, your love is dead. I got a lemon this morning, I do. You rang it red.
So there you hear a kind of old original, or as John Mellencamp says, not the very original, but Death Letter by Son House, that kind of blurring of the lines between love and obsession that made the blues hard for America to take for a while. Now let's get the John Mellencamp version from the CD, Trouble No More, John Mellencamp, Death Letter.
I got a letter this morning, what you record and read. Hurry, hurry, the woman you love is dead. I got a letter this morning, what you record and read. It said, hurry, hurry, the woman you love is dead. So I grabbed the cross and keys, head out down the road. When I got there, she's light out.
John Mellencamp, what did it feel like to try and connect with that kind of obsessional, penitent, lunatic feel at the bottom of Death Letter? Was that a natural place for you to go or not?
Death Letter, the Son House version that the record companies put out is not the whole song. They kind of sanitized it for him. But I found the other lyrics that he had written. I think on the record that most people hear by Son House, it's just a story about a guy who finds out his girlfriend's dead. The real song is you find out the guy killed the woman. Mm. And I thought, whoa, wow, that's serious. So we kind of did the non-published version of the song. I would imagine you can find Son House doing the entire song. But the original version I heard of this song a long time ago was very sanitized.
You've rolled it back a little bit here. John, I wanted to ask you about regionalism. In folk and blues, of course, regionalism is a very strong thread and tradition. You've had this kind of hot and cold relationship with your own regionalism, your Midwestern roots, a very kind of strong trademark or association during some periods of your career. At other times, we read you kind of edging away from that. Here you are, 52 now. How do you feel about the Midwest as an influence in your life, your work, your view of the world as an artist, the way it comes across in your work as an artist?
Well, the first thing I got to tell you, I'm only 51 and a half.
Okay.
So let's get that straight. Okay. 51 and a half.
We don't want to throw them away
easy. Yeah, 6 months is a valuable piece of time.
We're going to let you hang right on to that.
No, I think what I'm responding to is that people, after you've been around so long, just diminish what you're doing by saying, well, he's a Midwestern rocker. It's like, well,
What the heck is that?
Right. Yeah, what is that REO Speedwagon wrapped up with, you know, I don't know, you know, come on, what is that? So when I read things about myself and they just kind of say, well, he's a Midwestern rocker. I see him doing the same thing to this Kid Rock guy, and I know him. And, you know, he refused to leave Detroit. And I just read in a magazine where it said good things about him and bad things. One of the bad things is that he won't leave Detroit.
Right.
So, you know, these people in New York and Los Angeles or the coast, you know, he won't leave the Midwest.
But on the other side of that dismissive attitude, you were saying earlier how the drum – you could hear the room in the drum on this album. There is something important about regionalism as well, something that's very positive, it seems to me.
Well, you know, that is what this country is founded on. That is the backbone of this country. And through corporate America, I blame them for everything. We are losing our regionalism. I mean, not too many years ago, you could tell a guy from Los Angeles from a guy from Louisiana, a guy from Boston, because we all looked, talked, and dressed differently. Mm-hmm. Now, because of, you know, different clothing lines and satellite television and, you know, big corporation networks and blah, we're all seeing the exact same thing at the exact same time, eating the exact same food, wearing the exact same clothes. You know, I always wondered what would happen when the entire population of the United States became hip, when we all got tattoos and started wearing earrings. You know,
what a picture.
Everybody's so hip, you know. I mean, why, it's easy to be hip now. Yeah. I mean, you know, there it is. I can see it on TV. It's there's no research, there's no soul searching, and that rolls back into the music too. I mean, you know, when my dad got a couple tattoos, I thought, well, you waited 60 years to get tattoos?
Please, Dad.
What's the deal? You know?
Boy, John Mellencamp, it has been a tremendous pleasure talking with you tonight. I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Well, listen, thanks for having me.
We're glad you took this this swing to the old-time music. It just sounds terrific. A terrific album. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, you guys.
John Mellencamp, his new album is Trouble No More. We're going to go out listening to Lafayette, a Lucinda Williams composition from the CD. For more on John Mellencamp and his music, go to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Oh, those girls, Lafayette.